Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host, Mayu. That was just going to be me today for the preamble. I know everyone's bummed out. Austin does bring a little bit of joy into these conversations, but it's been a crazy week for investors. So we've got a lot to talk about, kind of dissect this, and I'll go into the podcast today as always, right? But we had the budget come out this week, a nice 40 billion dollar deficit. Now keep in mind, it's a $40 billion deficit in Canada with tax increases. So really, we're increasing spending by much larger than the $40 billion amount, right? There's a lot of discussions on social media surrounding the cap gain tax increases, essentially, right? So they're increasing capital gains to 66% on anything over $250,000. If you're one of the smarter investors that have their real estate in corporations, we're now going to be paying 66% capital gains tax on the entire thing, regardless of the $250,000 limit. So that kind of sucks. You know, conversations with others, we're seeing like capital flight, right? So we're seeing capital being reallocated outside of Canada, not just by international investors, but even investors in Canada. And that's not like overall, that's not considered good for the economy, right? An increase in taxes is really the last thing we need in Canada. We need more capital to flow through the economy, right? And you then increase the productivity of that capital. And right now, we're essentially just giving that capital through the form of taxes to our government. And we all know that government is not a productive user of capital. It is what it is. It's very inefficient government as a whole, right? So not to get too political here, but, you know, so we had that kind of news coming into the market early this week. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday. That followed by the US, which is now saying, I think they started off the year saying they're going to do 4 or 5 cuts this year. And now most of the forecasts are down to anywhere from 0 to 3 cuts in the US, right? The only thing that, you know, me and Austin have touched base on this on the side as well. And the only thing that we're kind of hopeful on is the BOC is basically saying, you know what, fuck the currency, right? Whatever happens, happens. So they might still do the cuts here in Canada because we definitely don't have it nearly as good as the US has it right now, right? At the same time, our personal portfolio, you know, my personal stuff, I've got a phase 1 going on that multi that we have under contract. Site visit is next Tuesday. So I'm still keeping my fingers crossed that, you know, hopefully it comes back clean. Because if it doesn't, it's going to get messy and we're going to have to figure out where we go from here. But we've also had quite a few capital calls this week on the portfolio. Our sewer backup property, that's costing us in repairs. We have a foundation issue on a set of 3 towns. So, you know, the life of a real estate investor is never ending, it seems, right? I did have a call with Dan Illes for anyone that did catch that episode that we did with him. I think it was 1 or 2 weeks ago. Definitely, you know, go check it out. It was to consult on kind of like what we could do with the project. So we're looking more into the development space as well, right? And here, I'm going to hog up a bit of screen time and kind of talk about the trends that we're seeing in the real estate world. This is like anecdotal conversations from my clients, from other investors, and just what we're seeing on social media. There's number one, I'll say there's a big migration to the US, right? I don't think this cap gains tax like single-handedly makes the US that much more enticing. But it's an indication of like where our economy is going. I think the US makes sense for anyone that's willing to ever move there, ever willing to kind of consider living their life in the US, which just isn't for me right now, right? Number two, I'm seeing and having more conversations with people in the development space right now. Just this week, we had 3 different deals all related to development kind of come across our plates. So that's been interesting as well. Number three, I'll say, you know, we're also seeing a lot of people becoming more aware of CMHC MLI Select and the potential benefits on commercial financing, right? So that seems to have finally trickled down into the various communities out there. We're doing commercial files all over Ontario right now. Larger cities now work decently well because the numbers work a lot more, right? So if you guys are interested in that space, shoot me a message. I'm happy to help and kind of talk about that. But where we used to be doing like Windsor, Sudbury, et cetera, because those are the only markets I really debt serviced or cash flowed. With the increase in rents that we've seen in some of these larger cities compared to the tertiary markets, it makes like London, Ontario, for example, a lot more attractive, right? What we're not seeing a whole lot of, I'll say, is the smaller, easier flips, right? So I do think there's an opportunity for anyone looking at smaller projects that have a heavy renovation spend, or even some of these like quick, like hotel-ish type deals, right? To grab some deals out there. I think people are shying away from the bigger renovation projects. So that, you know, really always yells out opportunity to me, right? So that being said, I did read something on the news as well recently, kind of on the increase in the number of non-paying tenants. I think it was in Kitchener. It's just an overall increase in the number of non-paying tenants and tenants just refusing to pay rent. So this week's episode is very timely. It's another issue that investors are dealing with. And I know there's a lot of issues that we're all dealing with right now, right? But it's essentially combating a tenant population that's dealing with the same stuff that we are, right? So increasing cost of living, rents being jacked up, unemployment going up, right? They're also much more knowledgeable, unfortunately, about how to game the system, right? So make sure you guys listen to today's episode. Andrew's a world of knowledge. He's a very smart guy and someone I've leaned on quite a few times for sure with regards to any of my tenant-related issues or questions. And if you haven't had a tenant issue yet, just stay tuned. You'll have one if you're buying real estate, right? It's just the reality of it. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If you do enjoy the episode, make sure you guys share it with a friend. As always, if you can drop a 5-star review for us, it just helps with the growth of the podcast. I really appreciate it and tune in, guys.
Just a heads up before we get started, this podcast is all about providing you information, not financial or legal advice. So if you need the real deal for your situation, hit up a professional. We can't promise you our information is always up to date or accurate, and we're not responsible for any investment decisions you make based on it. Markets change, information change, you know the drill. Anyways, thank you for hanging out with us responsibly. Let's jump right on in. Thank you guys so much for joining us in this live Ask Me Anything session. If this is your first time joining an Ask Me Anything session, basically what we do here is every month we bring on an expert guest to answer any burning questions you have on their expertise. And this month, it's going to be all about the Landlord-Tenant Board, Residential Tenancy Act, and landlord and tenant issues with no other than Andrew Trebetta. For those who don't know who I am, I'm just going to be the host today. And if you guys have any questions, feel free to drop them down below in wherever you're streaming it from, and then we can overlay it on the screen. My name is Austin Yeh. I am a real estate investor and a mortgage agent with Vine Group. Also founder of Rise Network, which is a real estate community with 100 members. So if you guys aren't a part of Rise Network, I suggest that you join it. There's a ton of engaging conversations. And we have my good friend and special guest expert, Andrew Trebetta, joining us, who is a paralegal and partner at Caveat LLP. I'm sure that you're going to give a much better intro on yourself than I did. So for those who don't know who you are, Andrew, why don't you give a quick intro?
I am I have to always say it first, I'm a real estate investor first, paralegal second. And I work with a lovely trio, myself, colleagues Glenn Gosling and Angela Smith. We primarily deal with all investor-focused issues, right? So small claims, but the bread and butter is landlord and tenant. We deal with a significant amount of issues. So the boring stuff, like the non-payment of rent, and then your more escalated things like, you know, drugs, guns, and rock and roll and everything else that go with like being a landlord and being an investor. I primarily started the journey into real estate. I had the benefit. I started like 10, 15 years ago when I was working at Keller Williams Complete, where I used to work as a desk secretary at a brokerage. And then from there, transitioned into law and then continued. So I've been working in real estate for, most of my adult life at this point. And I went from, you know, doing the, you know, the assistant thing, like the menial labor, what can you describe it that, to, you know, running my own office now is, it's been a fun journey. You know, and then schooling and a lot of schooling to get through all of it. But you know, it's been fruitful, and then I certainly enjoy it.
Awesome. I think today is going to be a pretty exciting session. I feel like a lot of people get into real estate investing not understanding the risk that they're getting into, especially in Ontario. And I'm sure that you deal with a lot of investors that think that they might make a profitable investment, but things may go sideways with the relationship with the tenant. It could end up costing them a lot of money. So guys, I know that we're all I'm definitely going through some stuff. So I'll share some examples throughout this. But if you have anything that you're going through, feel free to drop them down on Facebook or on Instagram and we'll get to them. But let's just start off lay of the land. Very basic question. What is the Landlord-Tenant Board? What is the Residential Tenancy Act?
Okay. So if you're an investor in South Ontario and you own property, the RTA is your bread and butter, right? It's your interaction and the laws around the interaction between yourself and your tenant, right? So I recommend every landlord to have a copy of it, like just sitting on their decks, you know, laminated, right? Just to look over and that type of thing. And the landlord tenant board is the judicial body that handles any disputes between the landlord and the tenant. Now, important to note, it's not like the, don't let the name fool you, right? It's the landlord and tenant board, but it's based on, original law was actually not called the RTA. Original law was actually called the Tenant Protection Act. So, and it's also a tribunal, not a court. So people think, and investors are unfortunately the ones that that have to get a rude awakening, and they think it's fair and unbiased. It's not supposed to be, right? It's not supposed to be, you know, people, they watch Law and Order and they think it's going to be like that. It's not that. It's their design, you know, primarily to protect the tenant. And that's usually what you hear from the horror stories from a lot of people. Because not necessarily just because it's, you know, harsh against you, that means it's okay. So, you know, it rounds itself off, but it, primarily speaking, the LTP is the court of, you know, paraphrasing here, the court of what you're doing.
Right, understood. So, I mean, interesting point that you mentioned there. It was primarily designed to protect the tenant. So could you elaborate on what exactly you mean by that? Because we hear a lot of people throw around the LTP is broken, right? What is meant by that?
I was practicing beforehand, but I really started practicing back in 2018, right? Like really, yeah, and actually having a significant case. And I was there when you could take paperwork, walk over to the tribunal's office on Main, and then hand it to a clerk. They would stamp it for you and they check it. You don't get that anymore. You get a Salesforce-based online terminal where you have to file, okay? And digital is awesome. It's great, but it doesn't work well when you have millions of people that's supposed to be using a system. It doesn't, right? And the board moved on to a fully online and digital framework during COVID. And the beginning days of this were, as a practitioner, I can tell you from pure honesty, it was the Wild West, right? Because you couldn't get into hearings. You couldn't really deal with anything. It was very difficult. Even processing payments were difficult. And the backlog was significant because I don't know if people remember, but just before the COVID hit, there was a hiring freeze on all government workers, right? And this was Doug Ford's policy. And regardless of where you're left leaning or right leaning, however it went, that was maybe not the best, you know, decision for the LTB because there wasn't as many adjudicators. Then you had COVID hit. Everything was backlogged and stopped. And then just had the housing crisis just sort of, you know, go crazy. It was like adding some gasoline onto a tinderbox. And, you know, everyone into non-payment, no one was working. So you had all these enforcers to pop up. And then the nature of real estate, there was just more people trying to move into units, more renovations, more and more. Interest rates increased, which means investor had to, you know, start looking at ways of clearing out tenants and, you know, doing N13s and doing renovations because they needed to get their capital, you know, and they were going upside down in properties. I watched so many people go upside down during COVID, right? And then afterwards, you saw the flurry of people that were making money because they were buying those properties from those investors. Then they were able to hold out those properties and they sort of continue. And now we're sitting at 2024. And I can honestly tell you this, and I think it's maybe likely that the client is actually watching this live stream. I have a client that I have a hearing for on Thursday, which is probably one of the larger cases I have to deal with. And it's also been a thorn in my side. It has been going on since 2019. It is the oldest matter I had, and they just forgot about it. And people don't understand that the LTB can forget about a file, but it can happen where, you know, what ended up happening with this one in particular, the adjudicator was on medical leave and it just never got rescheduled. Now we would ask and ask and ask, and then we just never get a response. So a few years later, I happened to be inside a hearing room with the vice chair of the LTB. He was presiding, and that doesn't happen often. It's very rare that he's doing it. And we actually ended up bringing this file to his attention, and he ended up writing an order and sort of bumping it to the top of the queue to actually just get it started again. So, you know, and then I have about 20 or 30 files that just disappeared, right? Which is a very difficult thing to tell an investor, right? And you can imagine waiting 9 to 10 months after buy an acquisition and you're dealing with a turnover and you're representation. You call the LTB and then your representative says, hey, I filed this. This is ready to go. We're waiting for a hearing date. And then all of a sudden you get a call from the LTB. We don't have a record of this file number. It was never filed. No idea. And yet you'll have a filing receipt. You'll have confirmation. You'll have it sent through and it's just gone. I have gone through this many times. I've dealt with investors who just had their applications disappear, right? So, you know, I made a challenge to a bunch of my colleagues a few years ago about this trend started to happen because I had some obviously angry clients, right? That just had their things disappear. And I started to notice that one person put their hand up, hey, I've lost two in the past, year, right? And then after that, it was five, then 10, then 15. And, I deal with many applications. Our office has a considerable amount. And, 400, 500 applications. Out of the 400, 500, you'll have 10 disappear within a span of 2 years. For those people, that 10, it is catastrophic for those individuals, right? I had an investor lose three, entire property, the entire project was just gone, right? And what do you say, right? It's very difficult. People end up blaming you and it's a very hard thing to sort of swallow, but people need to understand that the LTB just doesn't work well on a procedural administrative level. When you go into the actual hearings themselves, again, like I said, it's not fair. It's not supposed to be, right? So people, you have an uphill battle and you get this for now, like the hot button topic is N13s, right? For renovation and demolition, right? The quote unquote, so renovation. It's hard to get those applications there, right? I used to do 20, 30 units, breeze through them. But now I'm doing a 20, 30 unit eviction for a renovation. I come in loaded for bear. I have the architect there. I have the investor there. I have the contractors there. I have the contractor's notes. I have, bylaw. I've got everything stacked up. And sometimes you'll still lose. They'll still say no, just for the sake of just saying, there's too much displacement. So no. Then they can do that. People don't understand that, right? It's like you spent $20,000 for architectural drawings and they just said, you have to repair. You can't completely replace. Well, how are you going to get financing for that? How's that going to work? Right. And people wonder why these projects sort of fall apart. And then you get individuals that aren't able to make payment on their mortgages and that type of thing. So it just doesn't work. It's just in every aspect, there's a failure there, right? And then that's sort of how it sort of leads off.
There's a lot to unpack there. I mean, one interesting thing you mentioned was about the N13. So for those who don't know what the N13 is, you mentioned the renovation, right? Evicting people or the tenants by renovating the unit or demolishing it or converting its use. The point that you mentioned there, it looked like one of your clients wanted to actually demolish the property and rebuild something on it. And they still lost. They still lost.
Think about that. Having a demo permit approval for a condo, a 44 unit condo. No, no. And the reason why, and this is the thing that I don't want to step too much into the myriad of if something is right or something, right? Because everyone has their own political opinions. Some people lean left, some people lean right. Like it's just what it is. But what I will say is if you have something that is legal, that is not within the benefit of the other party, does not necessarily mean that it shouldn't happen, right? And what I mean by that is if you've got a 44 unit building that you've paid millions of dollars to get placed up and it's going to attach, maybe not affordable housing, but at this point, just housing, right? Because there's not that much. You're putting these units up and there's one person living inside a single family home who's been there for 20 years and it's in our, late 80s, which is what this person was, that can find another place and just chose not to. Maybe not the best decision, I think. That's where I consider it, right? And this person was offered, Austin, $120,000.
Wow.
$200,000.
This is the case across any city, right? Like the city doesn't necessarily matter. This is province-wide. So whether you were to do an N13 in Toronto versus in Windsor, it could potentially lead to that same outcome, right? Depending on your adjudicator.
Very much so. Cash for keys used to still like, I hate that term, cash for keys, because I don't think it exists. So cash for keys is effectively, if you want to go up to your tenant, and sometimes some people do it after an application. So you have an N4 for non-payment of rent. and you have $2,000 to $3,000 of non-payment, or even 10 or five, right? And you go forward to them and say, I'm going to lose another $7,000 if I wait for this hearing. So I'll pay you five and I'll forgive all the rent. I'll pay you money just to leave so I don't burn more, right? Financially speaking, makes a lot of sense. That works for a lot of investors. But the reason why I say it doesn't exist is because these days, cash for keys, they don't fit, right? And not only that, it should be considered a settlement. You should be filing against the tenant and then finding a sort of a middle ground as to where to sort of get the tenant out of there, right? And that's either through moving costs, boxes, that type of thing. It should be allocated for certain things. Want to pay for the first and last? Fine. But you shouldn't be handing profit over to someone, right? So, but that's what ends up happening. You get tenants that'll ask for $30,000. They'll owe you money and still ask you for $30,000. I just had to convince an investor not to give out, I think, like $52,000. And I just went, no. Like, you know, and that, and this tenant owed $26,000.
So right? Basically, the cashing out, the tenant's getting $70,000.
Basically, right? And there's people that do this professionally. And this is the thing. Back in the day, professional tenants were rare. They're not anymore, right? You used to have like one or two people. And, you know, the rental housing enforcement unit used to prosecute these people and they would do like scams. Now it's daily. Daily you'll have this issue, right? Because there's no, like, think of it this way. If you could just get away with not paying your taxes, no one would pay them, right? Everyone has some gray area. Nobody would really want to be audited, right? It's that kind of mentality. So people sort of get away with it. But if you had no repercussions for this type of scenario, people would. Right, you know, people give a fake name. It's like, and it's these investors who are, you know, it's the mom and pop people, great people, but like it's the ones that are early 50s, late 50s. Yeah. You know, they're not going with the mentality of this is a business. This is their retirement, and you can't fault them, right? Because they make a significant portion of the housing stock. They bought this property, they're retiring, and this is what they're paying off the, you know, instead of CPP or you know, some sort of retirement. And they get cleaned out. They get cleaned out, right? This tenant goes in there, doesn't pay anything. They'll stay there for 12 months. Maybe the person didn't even check the ID, or maybe they do something faulty on the notice. It gets kicked. The person stays there for another 12 months. Well, the tenant doesn't show up and they appeal it. So it goes back to a new hearing. That's like 11 months. And so you just live somewhere for like 2 years, right? And the worst one is people that are professional, hire representatives, right? And to be honest with you, there's a lot of this conflict within some paralegal communities about practices of some of these practitioners and lawyers too. There's people that will declare bankruptcy. So your client, your tenant could owe you $50,000, but the order is tied to the money. So if that debt is wiped away and they don't owe you anything, the clock starts from the very beginning again. So you went through four or five hearings and you try to get this person out for 2 years. And then all of a sudden at the end, it starts again. They can do that, mm-hmm. Right? There's a lot of leeway for the tenants and not that much leeway for the landlord. So, we mostly spend our time being therapists along with being practitioners quite often.
Right, right. So there's a lot to break down there. Before I get into my questions, I do want to jump into some of the guest questions here. Asked on YouTube, is there a way someone can access LTB data? Actually, they had a follow-up. Can you get access to LTB court case data? Asking as a developer who would like to build something and make it easily available to others.
Yes, there is. So it just depends on what you're trying to... It depends on what you're trying to get, right? If you're looking for metrics for how many cases are being placed in, that type of thing, they publish that out on their website, tribunalsontario.ca. There is an Excel spreadsheet that you can pull up. It gets updated every month. It'll give you the metrics of how many things are filed, how many things are in backlog, etc. That's where you mostly see the news reports, how they, you know. But there's those metrics are political, let's just say, right? Cases heard. There's a reason why they say cases heard, not cases closed, right? Someone commenting open room as well. I'll get to that, but. There's mainly that if you're looking for information that has to get access to that. Also, suffice it to say, and this is shocking, but TOP, which is the developer arm of the Salesforce-based CRM that they use for the LTB, the OLTB system, for those cases is very, very good when it comes to trying to partner with. No one's actually done it, but there's a lot of companies that are like Rentivus, and like some of these other companies, they'll actually file things for you and it'll go directly into the system. I have not seen anyone get it to work yet. But the person that does that is going to make billions. If you look at it this way, that type of person that uses the type of software is not my competition, because it's always particular, and the shorter things are always the things that should be just done on your own, right? The N4 should be done by an investor. I don't want to do that, but I still do that for people that need them. So, you know, there's always that. But if you're looking for that information, then this you can just find it on their website.
Awesome. We have a second question here. I'm going through a situation where my tenant has filed a motion for an ex parte order where he was late based on the order date and still got the motion granted. I'm worried about how that will go for me. I can't wait more months for more delays.
Didn't pay rent for February as well. Sorry, it was late for January. As of now, he's threatening, asking for money for him to leave.
Oh, yeah. Sounds about right.
Okay. And this is Abby. An ex parte order. He's doing exactly what I was just warning Austin. He's just stringing you, right? So your next hearing, if he just had done it, it's already going to be on an expedited basis. So something you really should be doing right now, because it's already going to go as the fastest process. So if let's say he did this ex parte request in late February, let's say
why don't you explain what that ex parte order is for those who don't know?
Well, so an ex parte order is basically, you know, you have an eviction and it gets appealed. That's the best way that sort of, or reviewed is the best way I can apply it. An ex parte request is essentially, there's no way for you to answer to it. Ex parte, it's a Latin term, basically it means like without your knowledge kind of thing. If you send a request, if it gets approved, there's no defense to that. So someone puts something in, the landlord doesn't even know about it, and it gets pushed through. So whatever this was, this person either said that he paid it 5 days late, 6 days late, or he paid everything, whatever it may be. Some adjudicator decided that, you know, this was warranted enough, which means nothing. I once saw an ex parte order with a smiley face on it. That was the only thing that was in there, just drawn a smiley face, and they still granted. Wow. So, you know, it gets granted, it gets placed through, and then now he has to wait for a new hearing date. I actually wouldn't tell you to do anything, to be honest, because there's nothing really you can do. It'll come up on their earliest hearing date. And then make sure, I would say for that, make sure you have someone there if you're doing it by yourself. Get a practitioner to deal with that situation, because you won't be waiting another 10 months wrong. And just highlighting at the hearing how many times this person, and that you should be.
And in terms of this, kind of dives into collections as well. Let's say that individual was behind $20,000, $40,000. How is that judgment rewarded, and how does a client go about collecting on that? Because that maybe the tenant doesn't have that money sitting around. So could you walk us through that process?
Okay. So I tell every client it's forever and a day. That's how long you'll get your money. Right. But this is not America. You can't just hop a state line and disappear. Right. If you have a tenant that's running off on $30,000, I would recommend that you do a garnishment, right? Garnishment goes, like, there's several forms of garnishment. There's your employer, so that person's employer, you can garnish their checks. You can go after assets with seizure and forfeiture, and then you can also do seizure of sale of land. That's what everyone knows about, putting a lien on a property that tenant's likely not. You can go after the bank accounts. If you don't have that primary information, the only thing you need to know, like, and this is what I tell every individual who rents a property, if they don't have ID, do not rent to them. You'd be surprised at how controversial that is. People will still do it, right? So get the name, get the driver's license, get two or three forms of primary source ID with picture. And then if they have a car, get a VIN number of the car, or at least that, like, give me the make and model and get the license. I can run it and I can find it. I can find them from that car, right? But you'd be surprised people don't do that. And you just serve them with the garnishment. And if you don't know where their bank accounts are, you can do something called a debtor's exam. And what that is, it's like, usually it's about the first of the month or the second of every Wednesday of the month. There's a set schedule with each warehouse. The tenant is told to sit down, give all the finance. Where are you making your money? How are you making your money? You know, all these things in between. And if they're not on disability and they're paying rent somewhere else, that means they're making money, which means you can garnish. Mm-hmm. Right? So you'll always be able to get your money. About how long you want to do it. And this is the controversial, the hard answer to that is, how much money are you going to put to fight bad debt? Right. It may cost you $5,000 to go after someone who owes you 30.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the collection period, as you mentioned, could take a while to get 30,000.
Yeah. I have 60, 70 garnishments, something like that, out of our office. Right. Right. Just me. My colleagues, Angie and Glenn, have more. We collect a lot of money. You see the accounts, in reality, we collect around $200,000 to $300,000 a month. That's how much we collect from bad tenants. But in reality, it's not a lot. We take in $4 to $5 million. So, right? If today alone I had 5 hearings, and I calculated, just so I could tell you on this podcast how much money that was supposed to be recovered. The hearings that I had today, I had 5 of them. The total amount of non-payment equaled $242,000. Like, give me a couple of jokes.
Just for one day.
That's one day, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. And then, that's not counting damages, core costs, all this other stuff. Like, okay, that's just life, right? Every practitioner, I always say, every practitioner has two versions. You can find a paralegal that answers you, or you can find one that's good.
Right.
Everyone's busy. Every paralegal that's working in this field is just crammed. Like, there's not enough of us, unfortunately. And the ones that are there that are doing well are ones that are
just, right. Yeah. Right. Man, that is, that is unreal. I was reading an article, or not an article, I was reading a case, I don't know if you saw, but there was a case in Toronto where there was a professional tenant that stopped paying rent, and then it went to a hearing, and the tenant was trying to make it, they're trying to get out of the hearing, try to postpone it, et cetera, et cetera. And then the damages started growing and growing. And at one point, I think it was like 50 or 60,000. And correct me if I'm wrong, the LTB only grants up to 35,000.
Yeah, only 35. Okay.
So then they took it to the Ontario Superior Court, and the damages ended up being over 100,000. Mm-hmm. Now, hypothetically, if that tenant declares bankruptcy, are you out of luck in collecting?
No, because it's Superior Court.
Okay.
It's different. Yeah.
Okay.
The LTB is uniquely sucks in that kind of capacity. But unfortunately, there's not that many people that do those submissions. Like, if you came to my office and your amount in total of non-payment of rent was over 35,000, I would refer you to a colleague. If it was beforehand, I'd still tell you to file under the end process. A lot of good practitioners would tell you to do it, right? It's not that many paralegals that would actually recommend that you go to the Superior, because it's expensive. The biggest issue is that the cost jump on legal fees with the lawyers it's just like a standard application with myself is $1,900 plus tax, about $2,000. That's a standard application. The lawyer could be 5, could be 7, could be 10, right? So finding practitioners that are willing to accept that, like, a lower amount, like 5,000 or 4,000 to do a Superior Court matter, it's not a lot. And plus it's niche. There's not that many people that are going to Superior Court for rent, right? So you've got to have a lawyer that knows exactly about this type of process. And usually what that means is it used to be a former paralegal. It's a paralegal that's transitioned into a lawyer, right? My colleague, Angela Smith, is actually at law school. So, it's that type of thing, right? And there's only like 2 people that do that. 2, 3. And I know a lot of lawyers. It's just not that many that do that.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next question here. We have a couple more to get through. Please comment on the impact of openroom.ca. So why don't you explain what Open Room is and then give your thoughts around that.
Greatest thing since sliced bread. I love it, Austin. I love it. I'm gonna actually say her name because she deserves to be commended. She's one of the co-founders. Her name's Weeting Bolu. Never met the lady, but she's sanctified in my book. She came along, and one of my colleagues, Jordan Newford, fantastic paralegal as well, and then Leon Presner, I also works with her as well on Open Room. And it's basically just a list. It's a list of orders. So Canley, which is the traditional way that lawyers and paralegals look up case law, it's the main resource for all cases from Superior Court reported on, and LTB, OLTB, et cetera. Open Room is specifically just for tenants. And what they noticed was that the LTB was a reporting facet. Like, I do hundreds of cases, My colleague Glenn does hundreds of cases. You look me up on Cambly, you'll find 25, 26. Let's say if I do hundreds a day. So what OpenRoom decided to do was, okay, we'll just create our own database. So they took everything from Cambly, and they also took it from every investor, you know, reps, companies, and all this. And if you have a bad tenant, you can post it there. Right. And there's also things that you don't you won't get on Cambly. You won't get mediated. You won't get withdrawals. You won't get certain things, but you can post those. I don't know what media agreements, but I think withdrawals you can. So there's a lot of things to be said on withdrawal applications. Like say if I have a withdrawal at N12 that I filed back last year and it was for purchasers on usage, you may not want to have your tenant there that's been making you wait for 6 months. He's still left, but would you want that type of tenant in your property? Of course not. Right? So there's a lot of that stuff. So open room is gives you the name of the tenant, what they've done, and you know, so it gives you a better idea for tenant screening. It's essentially, I don't want to characterize, I think this is the general way of saying it, but I apologize if it offends anybody at open room. It's the bad tenant list that you want. It's legal. It's correct. It does everything perfectly. It does it well, right? It's that type of thing. And it's not controversial. If you don't want bad name, don't do stuff that will get you on to open, right?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I think the withdrawn part is extremely important because I just think about some of the matters that I had. For example, like non-payment of rent, some of the tenants may get close to catching up, not exactly. And then I may just forgive them for the last, whatever, $1,000, $2,000 and end up moving out before it goes to the LTV. But of course, I want it to be shown somewhere. And I guess open room does solve for that. Another question here. So I guess this is a follow-up to the situation with the ex parte order, I believe.
Oh yeah. That's actually a good question. So I can follow. So I can paraphrase what he's saying. What he's actually asking now is from the previous question from the ex parte order, what do I do? He broke the payment plan multiple times. So what he's gotten, and this highlights the problem, he's gotten something called a Section 78. On the ex parte order, previous one. Section 78's common term is penny in a day, right? Late one penny, late one day, off the way you go, right? Payment agreement, 90% of them have that in there, right? Now, he's broke the payment plan multiple times and they still haven't evicted him yet. So it tells you how much forgiveness they can give to a tenant. What the mistake likely of whoever's handling the file or it's the landlord direct, whatever it is, you need to make it abundantly clear through the client to the adjudicator that he is not willing to continue with the tenants. You got to force that adjudicator to provide the payment plan, right? It may have been a good payment plan in the onset. I'm not actually criticizing doing a payment plan. Payment plans can be great. There may be people that just breach immediately and just kick them out faster, right? I tell that to people all the time. Payment plan may be actually in a good set because I can do a payment plan 4 weeks later. If you don't pay, out the door you go if you're a bad tenant. But people that he's got a problem where he's paying late, but he's paying something. Those are very difficult tenants to deal with because you either are doing an N8 for consistent late payment or non-payment, and they can void out those orders really easily. So it's the in-between. Like I'd actually like it if he paid everything, I dealt with something else, or if he paid nothing. But that in-between part, that's where this individual is in that dangerous area. It's hard to evict a tenant. So whoever is dealing, if you have a practitioner already, that practitioner is dealing with a very hard tenant to evict. If it's you on your own, don't do that. Hire someone to deal with this because you're going to need someone that has some good submissions when going before an adjudicator, right? And the more experienced that person is, the more likely that'll happen, right? That you'll actually get.
Awesome. Next question here. How much money are, I guess this really depends, but what's the most amount that you've seen the landlord lose? And what's the average where they start going to you and asking for your assistance?
Longest is
more nowadays.
I don't see anything lower than 10,000. Rare. Yeah. Very rare. Yeah, yeah. Highest I've seen in just non-payment, I think is like 59,000, 60,000, right? And the worst damage I've seen was $1.2 million. I had a guy, well, this dude, he's and I'm not speaking ill of the dead, but he was just the worst tenant I've ever, just a bad person. Just there's no good silver lining with this. He I was evicting him from property downtown Hamilton, and he threatened to stab somebody with a needle, and he was HIV positive. He threatened a baby. That's how dark it got with this guy. And he stole 14 fridges and like 20 stoves because the investor had been putting them into a storage room it's a big apartment building. They had placed it because they were doing massive renos there. And they were also stolen. All of them. He had just sold them. I found out about after the fact, years later, that he had done that. And he just caused a ton of damage, right? So there's a lot of people that can cause a lot of damage.
So the police won't be able to help in any situation like that, even if it's stolen goods.
They can. It's about will they. You have to understand, tenant advocates have scared those guys. Like, I feel bad when I hear people, like investors, badmouth the cops when they don't help. Because I'm like, what are you going to do? If you're a constable, I know the law. I still wouldn't do it. I still wouldn't help you. I honestly wouldn't, because just the liability, my friend, if you're a cop and you put your hands on a tenant and someone takes that photo and it's you're not the sheriff, oh man, it's bad. They sued Hamilton police, like, it was an extraordinary number. So now, one of the things that I do is I'll actually show up to a property when there's an illegal tenant there, so there's no tenancy, and I'll convince the police to remove them, right? So it's bad. Like, I don't fault, but the cops, they don't.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy, though, because the other way around, like, the call with landlords, I feel like the police have more flexibility. Like, you hear cases where, let's say utilities get cut off. I think there was one in Brampton or something like that not too long ago where the landlord cut off utilities, probably because the tenant wasn't paying rent. Obviously, that's morally not the right thing to do. Like, you shouldn't cut off utilities, but they got arrested and charged for that.
Yeah, mischief. Yeah, it's a mischief charge. You think of it this way. Let's say I'm counsel, right? I work for U.S. Steel. I reach into your pension plan and I take money out of the trust account and I go gamble in Niagara, I go to jail.
Right.
I can't do that, right? And a tenant doing that, it's a difficult subject to approach, but this is not about, this is not some regular individual. I know that scenario you're talking about. It wasn't just a regular person who couldn't afford to pay, right? That happens a lot too. Those are good people that are just down in their luck and the investor gets hit. I understand it. But these are people that are actively taking advantage. And it's okay. I'll tell you this way. It's illegal in other places. It's perfectly legal in multiple other places in Canada. Right? The eviction process in Labrador, quick. You can shut off the power, the heat, everything after the eviction has been set. You're done. You call the sheriff. It's over. Like 3 days. It's quick. So it's legal in other, but here in Ontario, it's not. There's two places that have these types of laws. It's Ontario and then California. Really, really difficult laws to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. No, basically, yeah, just continue to make your property livable while not collecting any rent.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question here. And by the way, just to make this clear, guys, we're speaking on extremes. I will say that the vast majority of tenants that we've dealt with are overwhelmingly good people, right? But there are these extreme situations where people take advantage of the system. And that's where people need the most amount of help, which is why we're asking questions revolving around this. Okay, next question here. I'm aware of Open Room, but is there any sites landlords can utilize to report monthly rent payments or missed payments for tenants? I remember there used to be a registry where you could sign up a few years
ago. That registry got sued to the ends of earth. I remember that one, yeah. I think Front Lobby does. It's a company called Front Lobby. I actually met the CEO. It's a great guy. I actually defended a landlord and they were actually trying to go after Front Lobby, but saying it was like a bad tenant list, but it's a credit reporting list. And yes, someone just posted again, Front Lobby. It's like, yeah, it's Front Lobby, LOBBY. If you go to the Solo Group, which is the Small Ontario Landlords Association, they have like a drop down where all these resources that I'm talking about, I just took it from them. Like, I had it open right now. There's that resource is pretty good. And Front Lobby, yeah, you can report credit. It's good. You report it. And what I do is I tell every investor, when they sign a new client or a new tenant, in their lease, it says they can report it to Equifax and they can report it to Front Lobby. There's a signed consent. You can actually get the consent off the Front Lobby website. Just put it into your lease. Someone says no, don't dig them. right? Pay your rent on time, you'll be fine. Same with Rogers does.
Awesome. Ending a lease, I know that could be pretty difficult in Ontario for landlords. What are the methods that landlords can legitimately do to end a month-to-month lease?
This is without any issues, right? You're just trying to end something?
Right.
Okay. So those are no-fault evictions. So those are sale, move-in, or renovation. That's it. And theoretically speaking, in Ontario, there's no other way of ending it. You have to give a reason, right?
Yeah, renovations are less likely nowadays.
Yeah, because before that was the only other option. Which is, it sounds ridiculous, but there's no way of just like not becoming a landlord. You can't do it, right? So if you rent a property and you go, yeah, I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I'll pay the vacant home tax. I'll pay it, all of it. I don't think I'll pay that. Can't do that. It's your property, but you still can't do it, right? So a lot of people, regular people get wrapped up in that because they have like a vacation home or they have, you know, like the house that their son used to live in, but they're not selling, like sentimental value attached to that. So there's a lot of that type of stuff that gets sort of floated.
Gotcha. Really, it sounds like the most valid way is the N12 if you plan to move in or if you sell the property.
That's why people use it.
In situations like that, let's say that the tenant doesn't decide to move out, what are wait times looking like for cases like that? Are they expedited or are they the same as everything else?
They're 10 months, 11 months. Yeah, I can say it's a year, essentially. By the time I can get them out of there for you, it's a year. Right, if I just need the sheriff, it's a year. If I even like just get the hearing order, it's a year. So what I tell everyone is 12 months. That's a long time.
Have you had situations, let's say someone buys a property, closings in 3 months, the tenant doesn't leave. So obviously you have to take them to the LTB. And that being said, the deal falls apart, right? Like the sale falls apart because the buyer doesn't want to wait another 12 months before closing. Are you likely going to lose the LTB in that situation? Because
if the deal falls apart, it's done. The notice is voided. That's it. It's gone. Now, this is the thing. This is where everyone goes back and forth. What investors are getting savvy and doing is they'll just sell to another investor who will wait. It's a lot of people that do that. Like, so you hear about bad faith evictions in that sense. Now you're starting to get adjudicators get very, very curious as to what those APS are and how they're coming, right? So before, if you just had the APS, you would be able to evict them. But now you've got a lot more scrutiny because what realtors will do is they'll be the realtor that's selling the place, and then they'll get realtor number two from like their team or whatever to buy the place. And then you'll be going through halfway through an eviction and you know, they won't tell anybody. Then someone does a quick Google search. They figure out they're linked together and then they both get fined. So it's that type of thing. So that's what people are trying these days. Just see the next sort of level of trying to just get a clean property or clear property. But there's better ways of doing it. That's a bad faith lawsuit just waiting to happen. And fines are going up every day. It's 100,000, 200,000, and they're climbing, right? So it's, yeah. Corporations, right? I think corporations right now is like 500,000, something like that. Okay. Yeah. So,
however, if it's the other way around and rewarding landlords, the max is 35,000.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
It's both for fine, right? So then we have to be very specific. Damages are all capped at 35, including for the tenant. The fines are different, right? It's very difficult to find a tenant. It has to be done through the rental housing unit, and it's a lot of stuff. But for landlords, that recklessness.
In a bad faith eviction, who gets in trouble? The seller or the buyer? Let's say the buyer wants you to serve the N12 to the tenant, and then the buyer hasn't disclosed they're actually not moving it. The buyer is lying to both the seller and the tenant.
Okay. I'll answer this, but I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting you do this, right? Like I just use this example. Yeah. But
this is just as a seller, sometimes you may sell a property that's tenanted and you need to know what liability you could potentially be under if your buyer is going to explicitly lie to you.
Okay. It would come down to credibility, to be honest with you, because your buyer may just lie.
Right.
Right. But it brings the question as to why. But let's say he pulls out of the deal after the eviction because of financing clause. Like I was dealing with a matter like that a couple days ago. Like there was a legitimate sale, person was supposed to move in and the buyer walked away because financing fell apart. That's how it worked, right? It was a firm deal, but it still fell apart. Mm-hmm. So What I would say is I have to fence it and say it's complicated. The buyer could be fined. The buyer could be sued. The seller could be sued. The agent could be sued, right? Like the lawyers could may have an issue as well. So it just depends on what, like who started what and what was the actual reasoning. And then it can actually.
Understood.
Yeah.
So next question we got from Facebook. In your opinion, before going to the landlord-tenant board, how would you go about working with a tenant that's not paying rent or is behind by 2 to 3 months?
Two to 3 months. That's okay. That's a good question, actually. I want to call my colleague Angie and go back and forth with her and argue with her. To be honest,
it's going to also depend on how much they're.
Yes, but this question is a sweet spot. I can tell you easily if it's more, right? If it's more, then the best that you're doing is filing, serving, going straight to the eviction. And then before you get your hearing date, try to do a payment plan or Section 78. They won't pay it. They'll breach it. And then before you even get to the hearing, you can do an L4 and evict. That's the fastest, right? But when it comes to 2 to 3 months, you may just want to bribe them and maybe just do the flat. Just I'll pay you to vacate because you can see where it's coming, right? So that's a difficult question. It comes down to the demographic and the type of tenant. Right. If I expect someone to breach and they have habitual bad habits, I'll tell you just do the Section 78. That's the best way of doing it. I have to judge it by ear. I have to talk to the tenant first and see where they're coming from and what their demographics are, like who they are, what they're doing, that type of thing. And then I can give you a more detailed answer. But it either will come out to doing the payment plan or cash.
So next question we have on Facebook again, how do you collect all owing rent from a tenant that owes you $20,000 after they've already moved out and you do not have his address or job details, only their license ID?
All right. Asking them really good questions is very specific. We don't have any of his address or details, Owen Blazes and ID. There is a great practitioner. His name's Leon. Effectively, there's a system called Avis. Same system the cops use, right? And if you have the ID, the driver's license, as soon as it gets updated, you'll be able to find it. Now, when it gets updated, it's a problem. Some of these people just don't update their driver's license for 4 years. That's why I said forever and a day for your garnishment, right? As long as you have the ID, you're good. You're fine. Like we will be able to get them. You'll find them eventually, right? When they will change their address and you will locate. You may also be able to do it's something called a substituted service, right? You can appeal to the court to try to serve via email, or you have to exhaust every other possible way. It's a long drawn out process. It's not something that I would tell a regular person to go through. They have to use a practitioner for that type of thing. But substitute service is something you could do in that type of area. And it's mainly going to be through a paralegal or practitioner. That's a very good question, actually, because a lot of people get stuck in that position. They don't know what to do. It's mainly just giving real, like, you know, practitioner will give very realistic expectations of the client and just say, this is what you have. I will get to it. I will find them. Don't call me until another year, 2 years. Right. And then we'll actually be able to deal with it because I got to wait until this person changes their address.
Right. So it is a long drawn process. Don't go into this expecting it's going to be a couple months. We're talking about a year. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. And I think property managers don't always have the right answer to this as well. But when you're filing N4 forms, let's say non-payment of rent to a tenant, do you have to do it yourself? Does a paralegal have to do it? Can a property manager do it for you? Can one of your friends do it for you? And same thing with the L forms associated with it. Who has to file now?
Oh, I was just RV Shirelli. That's the law. That's the case law behind that. So this is the thing. The notice forms cannot be done by anyone apart from the landlord and the representative. Now, this is where property managers get very upset about. Technically speaking, they're not supposed to be doing those notice forms. Simple. RV Shirelli is very clear, right? But they get away with it. That's a big difference. A lot of adjudicators don't necessarily want to kick out an N4 when somebody owes $40,000, right? They're not necessarily interested in that. So there's a lot of people that get away with it. There's loopholes that you can do. I won't go into it because then people will do it. But there's a lot of ways of getting around that. But mainly speaking, if you want to make sure your application is not being kicked, either the landlord cites the notice or apparently. A lot of property management, services these days partner with a paralegal to deal with that. For example, we work with Melissa Dupree. We do some work with her. She's a fantastic representative. Property manager. There's things you can do to make sure your N4s are actually going and they're accurate, right? And it gets checked over and that type of thing. But the regular person, a friend, should not be doing those N4s. Just for understanding, like, God forbid something goes wrong, your friend is not responsible for that stuff. It's either you signing it or the actual representative. Like, you don't have to be cheap. You know, any Mohawk college student that knows the N4 process is better than you doing it. You can charge $10 to that guy. He's probably got a better chance than you do. So just have someone look it over. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I forgot who I was chatting with, but to your point, there's been situations where property manager was facilitating everything and then it goes to the LTB and it gets thrown out and you have to start from square one all over.
Bingo.
Right? So you wait another 8-9 months.
Yeah. And these property managers just think that they're doing everything okay because some adjudicators will be like, oh, you're a property manager. Okay. So they think it's validation, but they don't know they're just getting overlooked. If there's a practitioner in that room, it's also a controversial subject with some of my colleagues. There's some call of my colleagues will just say, you are not a legal licensee. You're not a lawyer. You're not a paralegal. You should not be doing them, period. Right. That's it, right? Because you don't have any insurance. You make a mistake, they got to sue you personally. I make a mistake on a notice, it goes on to my insurance, right? And you have none of this. So there's a lot of people that just dislike it and they don't want to advocate for people to do it. So it's that type of sense. Property managers do a lot of good work, but hey, hearing your client go through all the rigmarole because you just didn't sign it, you signed it in the incorrect, like, you know, 40,000, 20,000, can you imagine? Right?
Right. Yeah. Okay, another question here. When you purchase a property, let's say that the owner has already filed a couple of LTV forms, whether that be in N4, N5, and then you end up buying the property. As the new owner, do you still have access to those forms if they've already filed it with the LTB? And how does that process work? Do you have to get the old owner involved or are you able to facilitate everything with your own legal representative going forward?
Yes. Yes. It is possible. You can do it. Right? You can do it. It's not easy. Right? Like, okay, the big one is the N12. That's the big one. Right? Because you go through an N12 process, you kick them out, and then all of a sudden, it's a new landlord, right? I have never been able to transfer a matter from one seller to another buyer. I've never been in that scenario of actually happening. I know it's possible. If I had time, I would ask my colleague about how to do it. There's a case law reference that you have to use, specific case law reference. But there is a way of doing it, right? It's just I don't know off the top of my head. That's a very specific. Yeah. It's a very specific question, a very niche one, but yes, it's possible. Like, so I wouldn't be concerned doing it, right? It's the same thing like N12s. There's people that will say that an N12 can't be served if you're a corporation. You can. You just have to be the sole beneficiary, right? There's stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why as you speak to a realtor and they say you can carry it over, maybe always just double check with your legal representative if that's actually going to be the case and have a plan. If you're going to be relying on those other forms, have a plan and do your due diligence with your legal representative beforehand, before going firm on the property. Other question here, we have two more questions and then we can wrap up. How would you navigate this situation? I'm selling a condo with a tenant. They're paying rent, but are not helping with showings because they work from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Even on weekends, they're being very difficult to coordinate with.
Generally speaking, like I'll give you two answers. I'll give you the paralegal answer. I'll give you the real estate investor thing. I would say, make a schedule, make a showing schedule, send notices for 24 hours notes on this showing schedule, 3 or 4 per week, send out that way. Best way of doing it. The paralegal answer and the confrontational one is technically speaking, you got 24 hours notice. You've given 24 hours notice for a showing. They don't let you in, do an N4. N5. That's like the confrontational answer. That's because if you give for the purposes of a sale and you're stopping it, you're being difficult. Yeah. And it's warranted to an N5, right? That may be aggressive for some of my colleagues. They may not agree with, right?
Yeah.
But the heart of it is a breach of the RTA. There are some things that are going to work with us. I want to be clear. I don't do that from the get go, right? Especially for a showing. My first thing I try to do is work with a tenant and do a showing schedule. If they still start to be difficult, then I'll start considering. By then, I used to work doing pages for real estate agents when they would get their showings. So I know quite a bit about how to set up a schedule pretty good. So like I have more experience than most for those types of things. So I'm usually able to not let that type of thing escalate. I mean, typically able to get the people in. But if it goes further, then yeah, you gotta go.
So there's no ideal solution. Well, the ideal is to work with them, but let's say if they're going to be very difficult and they don't want you to sell the property for whatever reason, it's not the most ideal situation to go to the N5, right? Because it doesn't lead to an immediate resolution.
Yeah, there is no immediate resolution. Like that's the harsh thing. It's like you're in the middle of a short schedule. Yeah, I could deal with it. 7 months from now, 12 months from now. That's when it'll be.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think in a lot of situations like that, realtors try to find one day that works for most of the buyers going through and schedule them all in one day. But of course, that's not going to get you the most ideal price because everyone has different schedules and timings that they want to go through the place. And you can just give the tenant like $50 gift card in Starbucks to spend the day here, but it may not work in every situation. So our last question here is, how long are motion trials? I saw some today where adjudicator was conducting hearings during a motion.
How long are they? Depends on the motion. I could do a motion in like a hot 15 minutes. I can do it in 5. But then I can also do a couple that'll take me 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Right? It depends how complex. Regular motions, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Waiting is the worst. But motions are fast. Motion dates are traditionally faster than a trial. Yes, you. So I would say 20 minutes. But if you were asking me, gun to my head, how long it would take you, 20, 30 minutes to do an actual, like, you know, an actual motion.
Perfect. So that wraps up our Q&A session or Ask Me Anything session today. Andrew, really appreciate you jumping on. If people want to connect with you, maybe use your services, learn more about you, how could they best do so?
They can call us at 289-339-1311, which is our office line at Caveat LLP. You can look us up on Google, Caveat LLP in Hamilton. We operate all over Ontario, and you can reach us via Facebook at Caveat LLP. You can reach us via email at clerk@caveatllp.com. And of course, you can send us a cheeky Facebook message if you wish.
And your website is down below. If you guys see there, it says www.caveat.legal. Really appreciate your time. Honestly, this was a fantastic session here. I'm sure that I have a lot of questions that didn't get answered because there's a lot of people engaging, which is always a good thing. But we'll have to have you on the next time as well. Really appreciate it, Andrew. If you guys enjoyed this, there's going to be a re-recording on the Facebook group. So make sure to tag friends who might get value out of this. And until next time, everyone, invest smarter and live better. Take care, all.